This is Continent of Media 0610. Glenn Hauser here with our more or less monthly supplement to World of Radio. COM is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. It's made possible by Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. For a catalog, call 1-800-431-3939. Or check the website, www.universal-radio.com. Universal also sponsors www.dxing.com, where there's much useful information, including audio access to this program. Voice of America, Bethany, Ohio, is now officially historic. Kim Andrew Elliott.com reported on December 13th, that the former VOA transmitter building near Cincinnati has been named to the National Register of Historic Places. The Cincinnati Inquirer reported it well deserves the honor because of its important position in helping us win World War II and telling other countries the truth of what was happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. These stories tend to ignore the fact that in its later years, Bethany was used primarily for broadcasts to Latin America and to Africa. There were several other VOA transmitter sites better situated on the East Coast for broadcasting into Europe. The day before, another Cincinnati Inquirer story said West Chester Township was seeking 13 people to serve on a board to develop a museum at the old VOA Bethany transmitting station. The Oklahoma Observer has awarded a laurel to the Gallup poll for telling America the truth. Only 26% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Rush Limbaugh, the buffoon whose only appeal is to the intellectually challenged. Clear Channel Radio, which brought, to everyone's surprise, progressive talk radio, including Air America, to a number of markets, since it has more stations than it knows what to do with, has been taking it away. One of those markets is Madison, Wisconsin, certainly a place where left-wing talk would be appreciated, and is. They announced plans to convert the mic, WXXM 92.1, away from Air America to Fox Sports in 2007. But this has provoked quite a response among its loyal listeners and advertisers. There have been a number of press reports about this, including this from Madison.com, sent on by Artie Bigley. Clear Channel says high school and college sports are a better fit for Madison area listeners than progressive talk radio. Those are fighting words in Madison, a place where politics are fought between Democrats and liberals, and impeach Bush yard signs are not uncommon. The decisions by the nation's largest operator of radio stations to replace its highly rated progressive talk station here with Fox Sports has sparked a major backlash. Some advertisers have threatened to boycott. More than 5,000 people have signed a petition, and a rally was scheduled to urge the San Antonio-based company to reconsider. That was an AP story by Ryan J. Foley. Then another story about this from Madison.com by Kevin Lynch said efforts to resuscitate the progressive talk format of the mic have failed so far. Concerned listeners planned a funeral procession as of January 1st when the end of the format nears. The march was to begin at 1 p.m. at Brittingham Park and go down the road to Clear Channel Madison offices. A 420-page petition of more than 5,000 signatures to keep the mic on the air would be delivered to Jeff Tyler, Clear Channel VP of Marketing, by activists Valerie Wallasek, Gary Tipler, and businesswoman Barbara Wright. Isthmus in Madison also reported that the same Barbara Wright had cut a commercial to run on that station promoting the rally. However, they refused to air it at first until some changes were made. I say, since Clear Channel is divesting itself of hundreds of stations, why not this one in Madison and the few others carrying progressive talk and let some real liberals own and run them? Artie Bigley's in Columbus, Ohio, and it so happens there's another progressive station there, which appears on the way out. It's called progressive1230.com. Call letters actually WTPG. Their website has been saying in December changes are coming, although not making clear what those changes are. I wonder if they will continue to feature babes of the day on their website, a fine liberal tradition. Artie sends more press about this in other markets, including the Quad Cities of Illinois and Iowa. Mike Terry in England sends a press release he found from Los Alamos National Laboratory, December 18th, by Krista D. Black, new emergency management radio station on the air. Los Alamos County, New Mexico, has a new emergency alert station, broadcasting safety advisories about emergencies in the area, weather, community events, and public service. It's AM 1610, WQFJ 525. No commercials or entertainment. Strictly a tool to disseminate info to the public, says Phil Taylor, emergency management coordinator for Los Alamos County. And will help the lab report emergency info to the public. I suppose most hams have heard about this, but it is an important event worthy of note. A notice from the ARRL, December 16th, FCC to drop Morse testing for all amateur license classes. In an historic move, FCC acted to drop Morse code requirement. The commission adopted a report and order in WT docket 05-235. But it only issued a public notice about the close of business and not the actual report and order, so some details were not yet clear at that time. Prior to the long-awaited action on the Morse code issue, ham radio applicants for general and higher class licenses had to pass a 5-word-per-minute Morse code test to operate on HF. The commission says this eliminates that requirement for general and amateur extra applicants. And perhaps more important, the action appears to put all technician licensees on an equal footing once the report and order goes into effect. Holders of tech class licenses will have equivalent HF privileges whether or not they've passed the 5-word-per-minute Morse examination. ARRL continues, the wholesale elimination of a Morse code requirement for all license classes ends a long-standing national and international regulatory tradition in the requirements to gain access to amateur radio frequencies below 30 megahertz. The first no-code license in the U.S. was the technician ticket, instituted in 1991. The question of whether or not to drop the Morse requirement altogether has been the subject of often heated debate over the past several years, but the handwriting has been on the wall. A number of countries, including Canada, no longer require applicants for amateur radio license to pass a Morse code test to gain HF operating privileges. Thanks to a number of contributors for sending along the FCC press release and or the ARRL announcement, including Brock Whaley, Bill Smith, Dave Alpert, and Ken Kopp. On the WTFDA list, Peter Baskin, JD, LLM in Tennessee, clarifies about the technicians. It means that codeless techs will have limited HF privileges, including 200 kilohertz of phone on 10 meters once the order is final. If you're one of those, go buy a used Radio Shack HTX-10 or something and throw up a dipole, maybe 16 feet of wire. Fun is now available to you on the cheap. Here are some thoughtful comments about it from Sheldon Harvey, VE2SHW in Montreal, which he sent to DX Listening Digest. Many of you know how strongly I have felt about Morse code as a requirement for HF amateur radio licensing. I've always said that something that is classified as a requirement should require retesting maybe every 3 or 5 years. Instead, an amateur radio operator basically required code for one day in his life, that being the day before writing the exam. If he passed, it would be an option to never use Morse again a single time, if desired. What sort of requirement is that? We saw Canada and a number of other countries gradually start to change requirements. One holdout has been the United States until now. Why has it taken so long? The why now part of the question has a very easy answer. The ham population continues to age. Pages of dead hams show up in QST each and every month. Silent keys, they're called. These people are not being replaced with pages of new hams. In a world where we have seen more developments in communications in the past few years than in decades, amateur radio, which for so long was at the forefront of technology, has been basically left behind in a cloud of dust. Any of you who have heard me speak at ham club meetings as many as 15 or so years ago heard me pushing for amateur radio to take a serious look at itself and realized that it was not going to be a growing and repopulating pastime unless something drastic like this was done. Unfortunately, I think it may already be too late. The second part of the question, why has it taken so long, is answered quite simply with a few words: stubbornness and tradition. For much too long, I heard amateurs throwing out the phrase, if we had to learn code, then everyone who wants to be a ham will have to. It's a tradition. Well, some traditions are good to keep, but when holding on to them threatens the future of the activity in which these traditions are based, it's time to let some things go. Amateur radio has been stubborn. Deep down, groups like ARRL, Radio Amateurs of Canada, RSGB, saw what was happening and refused to admit defeat. When amateur radio in Canada changed the regulations with respect to Morse code and HF licensing, there was not a crush or lineup at the gate by people, even those who already had basic licenses, to get on HF. Had the dropping of code altogether happened when the code was dropped for basic licensing, amateur radio may have seen an even greater influx of new people. Now, I honestly think it is too late. Short of handing out free ham radios and antennas to members of the public, this change in licensing requirements isn't going to make a difference. A few short years ago, I went on record saying that I believe that within a few years, at least here in Canada, we were on the road to virtual total deregulation of amateur radio. The way things were changing seemed to almost parallel what took place with CB radio not long after it peaked. With the changes now being announced by the FCC, we are one major step closer to that becoming a reality. Some will no doubt be shouting about how terrible a thing this announcement from the FCC is. Others will applaud it. Sheldon Harvey concludes, I personally don't think it will make a whole hell of a lot of difference. At this point, I'm afraid it's just too late. It's really kind of sad. Here's an important issue not limited to the American continent, which has not been receiving much attention. Perhaps we can rectify that. Des Walsh of the UK wrote in DX Listening Digest, last September, I've been hearing a very widespread pulse-type interference across the shortwaves for nearly 2 years and wonder why I have not seen any reference to it anywhere, despite having written a few letters to Magazine, Practical Wireless, RSGB, Radcom, and others, with little response. The pulses are about 5 per second, not unlike those heard on the Russian time frequency station on 9996 kHz, and are some form of over-the-horizon radar, but what astounds me is that, unlike the woodpecker of years ago with a limited bandwidth, this thing can be heard over all frequencies of about 6.8 right up to 25 megahertz at times, but usually strongest around 7 to 9 megahertz and 12 to 15. Usually it can be heard during the day, but not exclusively, depending on propagation conditions. It cuts across broadcast, amateur, marine, and aeronautical frequencies, and when strong can be heard as a ta-ta-ta-tat with signals and often equal in volume. I've heard it in the southeast of Spain as well, somewhat stronger and for longer periods. I suspect it is coming from East or Southeast Asia, but cannot be sure. Certainly with strong Chinese and Australian signals, it is strong at the same time. One evening I was tuned to ABC at 2200 UT on 13620 and BBC 15400, when I noticed what I call the clacker pulse in the background. It suddenly disappeared after 20 minutes. It's never done this before. I've even made a recording of it. To produce an RF pulse that covers nigh on 20 megahertz of spectrum to be heard thousands of miles away takes some transmitter, aerial system, and power. Yet, so far, I've not seen any reference to it, and this puzzles me. One suggestion was that it is over-the-horizon radar in Cyprus, but I think not, with the variation in signals heard over periods of time. The second source of noise is nearer to home. In fact, it's in the home. Modern switched-mode power supplies are now everywhere, especially as power chargers for much electronic equipment, PCs, computer, cameras, DVDs. Some produce white noise hash over LF and HF frequencies, other pulses of wobbly noise varying across wide frequencies, and worst of all are the electronically switched small fluorescent bulbs we are being encouraged to install. The older, heavier variety with choke capacitor starting were no noisier than the tube variety, but the imported new ones produce a terrible amount of HF hash right across all high frequencies and wipe out weaker signals. More and more difficult nowadays to listen to shortwave with all the junk electronic equipment around, producing more and more interference, and no recourse in reality to have it quietened. If you complain, you're treated as a nuisance at best and a nutter at worst by people who don't care. A dedicated shortwave listener's life is a difficult one. Those comments by Des Walsh in the UK brought this reply from Joaquin Tamasanis, IN8ODJ. The first impression I had was he was wrong. No OTH radar was the culprit, but rather a switching type power supply unit near his receiver, since the poor present propagation conditions favored noise against wanted signals. I retained this impression during October, but propagation worsened in November, at least as I could appreciate from my QTH in Madrid, Spain. So then I recalled Walsh as I started hearing a noise similar to what he described, more and more persistently, but with a greater pulse rate, about 10 per second. The audio profile of such interference was as if a helicopter was over the signal. I first heard it on the 25-meter band at noon, but I soon found it through the 49-meter up to 19-meter band in the daytime, and nothing at night. As days went on, this helicopter-like interference, which was continuous, not on singular bandwidths, widened on the shortwave spectrum and increased in strength. On December 3rd in the morning hours, it came to cover all the HF bands continuously from 3 to 22 megahertz. There were occasions when I could have even picked it up on the lowest part of the commercial FM band. The noise now interferes with the BBC World Service, conceals Radio Exterior in Nobleja, Spain completely, and emerges at whatever time, night or day. The position of my random wire antenna seems to have no effect. Then I decided to do some surfing on the net and found that in Jindalee, Australia, there's a 560-kilowatt over-the-horizon radar in service since 2000. Note that from that year till now, solar flux did nothing but drop. Was it possible for the noise to have been coming from Australia since 2000 and now be heard but not before? If so, why was Walsh the only one to have reported this noise among so many DXers? Anyone else but Walsh and myself now? I also learned that the U.S. Air Force keeps 6 over-the-horizon radars in a sort of standby mode both on the west and east coast, aimed at environmental purposes. When operative, total area coverage of these radars will be 90 million square kilometers in open ocean, as they admit. Total radiated power would be 100 megawatts, covering 6 bands in the 5 to 28 megahertz range. They say the waveform cycles about 10 to 60 times per second in a bandwidth of 5 to 40 kilohertz. Supporting the radar hypothesis was an item from the Conexión Digital list of October 22nd. Chinese over-the-horizon radar tears up lower ham bands, IARU Region 2 Monitoring System Coordinator Bill Zellers, WA4FKI, says amateur radio stations on the west coast and as far east as Arizona have reported hearing OTH radar signals on the low bands. VE7BZ in British Columbia recorded the signal October 1st at 1353 UT on 3795 kHz. This radar, apparently located on Hainan Island, People's Republic of China, has shown up on the 160, 80, and 40-meter bands and sometimes is quite strong, 40 over 9, and the radar was obliterating 160 meters in the Far East. On 80 or 75, it appears as high as 3.8 megahertz, while on 40 meters, it's showing up in the lower 25 kilohertz or so. Typically, there are about 50 seconds between signal pulses. Thanks to Joaquin Tabasanas in Spain for those comments, clearly a topic which needs further investigation. On the IRCA list, an interesting thread about early car radios, started by Mike Brooker in Toronto. Did they have car radios in 1941? In those pre-transistor days, the radio must have taken up half the dashboard, and the tubes would have kept the car warm in winter. Willis Monk in Old Fort, Tennessee, an old-timer, replies, yes, they had cars, and the cars had radios. They used metal-covered tubes, and the tubes were black, all had 6-volt filaments. The world even had radar. The battleship USS Texas was one of the first to have radar. They even had television with football and baseball games. Channels 2 and 4 in New York City came on the air on July 4, 1941. So the world really hasn't changed much since 1940. And the radios did not take up half the dashboard. They were bigger than today's radios, but they had to be. They had to have a vibrator and 0Z4 tube to create the AC to run the filaments. But audio quality was so much better than today's car radios. If you were not around then, you missed a lot. Powell E. Way replies, that was until Motorola and Sylvania came out with Loctol tubes. glass tubes with snap-in, lock-in bass. Philco loved to use them in their consumer radios. Willis Monk replies, they were all 7-volt filaments, had silver tops, and if you were not careful, you would rub the tube numbers off the top. My 1954 Chevy had those type of tubes in it. And Eric Floden in British Columbia says, I thought I recalled a restored 34 Ford with a radio, so I Googled first car radio and got this car radio in 1929. American Paul Galvin, the head of Galvin Manufacturing Corporation, invented the first car radio. They were not available from car makers. Consumers had to purchase them separately. Galvin coined the name Motorola for the company's new products, combining the idea of motion and radio. It came from the website inventors.about.com. The whole middle part of the dash and under the dash. My grandmother's 1947 Studebaker had a radio with 14 tubes and push-pull audio, 6-volt system, and it drew 20 amps. That was one of the best car radios I ever heard, says Powell E. Way. And Motorola made some excellent car radios, as did Philco. I have a Motorola 61T23 table radio with tuned radio frequency that says Galvin on the back. It's from 1939. I put in orange drops back in the late 60s, and it worked for many years. It doesn't receive anything at all, but the tubes are fine. One of the capacitors may have failed. Eric Floden replies, I DX'd for a few years with a 1957 Buick or Ford car radio I bought from Bill Rochko in Akron, Ohio. It was sweet, very nice indeed. In addition to the regular push-button tuning, it had a town and country bar, which was a motorized scanning device. Town had little sensitivity. Country stopped on weaker signals. If I recall correctly, I only quit using it when the 110-volt AC power supply gave up. It was a very nice rig and delivered excellent sound. This was when I lived in Ottawa around 1970. Thanks to RadioIntel.com, we found this story at azcentral.com, meaning Arizona, by Clay Thompson. No cue about it, trains give a hoot and a toot. It's apparently in a column of his called Valley 101. Today's question, is the train whistle signal toot toot to toot, the Morse code letter Q blown as a train approaches every railroad crossing, a government regulation, and why the letter Q? Trains are required to signal whenever they approach a grade crossing, but I think that particular long, long, short, long signal was a tradition before it might have been required by law. And it doesn't have anything to do with Morse code. The Q thing is just a coincidence. Back before they could use radios or walkie-talkies, railroad engineers needed some method of communication with their crews or with the rail yard workers or anybody else who needed to know what a train might be up to. So they came up with a series of whistle signals to let others know what was going on. Why the long, long, short, long pattern for a crossing? For one thing, it is distinctive, sort of dramatic. It's a good attention-getter. You're not likely to miss it, and you're not likely to mistake it for someone just tooting a train whistle at random. One thing I read said that an arrangement of long note, short note, and long note at a lower pitch was a very common cliche in Renaissance music, but I doubt if a lot of early train engineers had studied much Renaissance music. I'm told that patterns of notes, this pattern is a mordant, but since I don't know exactly what a mordant might be, I don't know if that is so. Anyway, there are all sorts of train whistle signals. When a train passes through a station where it is not stopping, it sounds one long blast. Two shorts means a train is about to move ahead, and three short toots means it is getting ready to back up. You probably think I knew all this, but actually I stole most of it from www.sdreader.com. From the WTFDA list, a discussion about buying a new TV set. Initially, the questions are from Jim Renfrew and the answers from F.H. Prentice. I'm looking to buy a new TV, so this will be mostly for entertainment, not DX. I have barely made it out of the 19-inch black and white world. All of the new choices are very confusing, and the 20-year-olds selling them don't do a very good job of speaking plain language. For example, terms like NTSC, ATSC, and QAM mean nothing to me. So a few questions. What must I look for to ensure that the TV will receive analog and digital over the air? We are not likely to subscribe to cable. Answer, make sure the TV has an ATSC or digital off-the-air broadcast tuner. All new TVs over 24 inches will have them by law. Note all the smaller, less than 25-inch analog TVs being dumped on the market. Starting in March, most TVs will be required to have ATSC tuners. QAM tuners are not in all SDTV, EDTV, or HDTVs. Those allow local digital stations, including those in HD, to be received via cable. Locals must be in the clear, according to FCC rules. Question number two, what's the difference between LCD and plasma? LCDs are much like modern flat-screen monitors on computers. They're rapidly dropping in price and have good picture quality, but not as good as cathode ray tubes. But a much better buy than plasma. Plasma is overrated, a hog on electricity, and has a reportedly short life cycle. CRT widescreens kind of died for the most part with the passing of HDTV monitors, but a few, notably Sony, Samsung, and Toshiba, still make CRT HDTVs. What is contrast ratios? They seem to run from 1,000 to 1 up to 4,000 to 1. Is that significant? Well, higher contrast ratio means better detail and quality of picture. Are there some brands to steer towards or away from? The brands available at Circuit City are well known: Sony, Samsung, Mitsubishi, Philips, and Sylvania. Answer: the slim fit Samsung CRTs have had some issues with geometry, according to some posts. I nearly purchased one, a 27 4x3 HDTV with ATSC tuner, but I opted instead for the Panasonic CT26WX15. I would stay away from Funai brand products. Sylvania and Emerson are made by Funai. One thing to look for in the new TV is HD inputs. Make sure you have at least one HDMI and two component inputs. In the Nashville Fly Sheet, Jerry Strawman in Iowa remarks, "My newer 32-inch tube-style TV is the biggest electronic polluter I have experienced. I need to cover the cords with toroids. Neighborhood noise has increased exponentially in just the last year." And finally, I, Glenn Hauser, say, "I can't vouch for all models, but I've had best luck with Toshiba analog TV sets in minimizing TV interference hash on short and medium wave. I just got a new 14-incher, and now I don't have to turn it off except for very weakest DXing on short wave." Finally, an item from the Bolivian news agency, Via Jose Bueno, that the Bolivian parliament has decided to authorize a new shortwave station for rural development. It's on behalf of the labor union of field workers in Pando, but no further details. Glenn Hauser concluding, Continent Media 0610, also known later as World of Radio, Extra 74.